You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll hear about a UW study that may help us figure out what a person's smile really means.
First, Donald Trump's victory in November did more than install an administration with the power and motivation to dismantle a lot of former President Obama's legacy. It also sped up the timetable for Obama staffers who are planning to run for office someday.
From Texas to California to Michigan, a lot of alums of the Obama administration moved back home and launched bids for Congress and other elected offices.
Campaign reporter Elena Schneider wrote about the trend for Politico. Elena, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, Elena, how many former Obama administration staffers are currently running for office?
Well, we've got about a dozen who are running for the House at the moment. There are a slew of candidates who are running for down-ballot positions, school board, assemblymen, city council. So it's hard to judge at this point because there's so many who are still getting in, but I would say, you know, we're at about 50 people at this point.
Now, are these people who would have run anyway someday, even if a Republican hadn't won the White House?
Well, I think each one has a different story as to how they came to deciding to run for office. I think certainly some had it already in their mind that they might be interested in serving again in a public service role than running for office. But I think that by watching Trump be elected and seeing time and again how he has made disassembling the Obama legacy a central part of what he wants to do in office, that really disturbed a lot of the administration officials that were a part of putting it in there in the first place. And so I think for plenty of people, that was so much of the urgency that got them to run sooner or at all for public office.
Can you tell us about one or two of them and how they decided to run?
Sure. So we've got Andy Kim is a former Obama National Security Council advisor. He works on advising the president on ISIS strategy. And he decided to challenge New Jersey Congressman Tom MacArthur, who's a much more well-known these days given his participation in the Republican health care bill and getting that through the House. And Andy talked extensively with me about how he felt watching that happen and watching them trying to repeal Obamacare was a key reason why he decided to get in. And for the same reason, we've got Colin Allred, who was a White House intern and also worked in HUD with Secretary Castro, who helped with the transition when the Trump team came in and realized right around Christmas as he was helping to hand over the keys to his office that this was a moment that he felt suddenly very compelled to get involved.
Now, having good connections is important in any field, especially in politics, but do we know if this connection to the Obama administration will be a big enough leg up to maybe help propel some of these former Obama aides to victory?
Well, Democratic primaries across the country are seeing a huge influx in people's interest in deciding to get in. Candidates are sort of falling from trees at this point. There's just so much interest and energy around running for office on the Democratic side. So when you've got a whole slew of crowded primaries in which you've got all sorts of people who are interested or who are running, everyone from self-funders to business people to local elected officials, it takes a lot to stand out, and it takes a lot of money to stand out. And so the advantage or the leg up that these Obama alumni have is they've got this built-in network of people who they've worked with in the past in the administration or in the campaign, so they can reach out to on these informal listservs that have popped up ever since the Obama administration left office, and reach out to them and say, hey, look, I'm running for Congress or I'm running for Assemblyman. Can you help out? Can you help me fundraise? Can you help connect me with the right consultant to help me get my campaign off the ground? Those are key connections and key access to networks that really provide a fundraising base that most first-time candidates will not have access to.
We're talking with Elena Schneider right now, campaign reporter for Politico, and she joined us to talk about a surge of former members of the Obama administration who are now running for public office. And you were talking about this networking organization. How organized is the networking? Is it something that's formalized, or is it sort of I call somebody up and they answer?
I think it's pretty organic. I think a lot of the candidates who I talked with spoke to sort of the organic, ground-up, grassroots nature of what characterized the 2008 Obama campaign, much of which was a very sort of flat organization in that the field staff works with fundraising staff, which works with the political staff. And so they're used to all sort of loosely working together and organizing from the ground up. And so in the same sense, the groups that have sprung forth have sort of come together naturally. And I wouldn't say that it's too formalized at this moment. I think a lot of people are just calling their friends and sort of getting things started that way. But there is something called the Obama Alumni Association, which sort of is as formal as it gets. It's got a formal listserv, website. But otherwise, by and large, these things are informally set up and informally run.
Is Obama himself interested? Is he taking an interest in some of his former staffers getting out there into politics?
So far, he hasn't in any way endorsed or specifically gotten behind certain candidates. I'm sure he's interested in letting those primaries run their course. But in the in Obama's final year in office, he decided to in fact weigh in on a couple of down ballot, House candidates, state's attorney in Chicago. He decided to weigh into these races and help boost people through his name and through his endorsement. And it wouldn't be shocked if he decided to get into a few races for his former employees going forward. We just haven't seen it happen yet.
Are you seeing any indication that Republicans are seeing a similar groundswell of candidates to back the new strand of the party represented maybe by President Trump?
Well, it's a harder thing to capture given that the Obama administration just got out of office, and so there are all kinds of those officials who are also of note are without jobs because I think a lot of people expected to go on to work in the Clinton administration. As far as former Bush officials or other presidential appointees who were in Republican administrations, certainly they have run in the past. But as far as people who are interested in helping to bolster the Trump agenda specifically, certainly there have been people who worked on his campaign. There was a gentleman who was running in Georgia's special election this past April, who had worked with Trump's diversity coalition to try, and he sold himself on those credentials, but he didn't make it through the primary. Obviously, it's still early at this point as we're watching candidates get in, but we're not quite seeing the same amount of groundswell yet from former Trump campaign officials running for office.
Right. As you say, it is early, but what are you watching for as a litmus test for how successful these former Obama staffers are going to be?
Well, there's no better litmus test than simply whether or not they win their primaries. An early indication, though, before we get to the primary process, a key element that every consultant, that the committees that help get these candidates elected, that they're going to be watching is the amount of money that they fundraise and that they're able to bring to the table and whether or not they're able to build a credible ground game and campaign. So I think watching fundraising numbers for these candidates is going to be key, but that at the end of the day, whether or not they get through those primaries and can go on to the general election will be a key litmus test.
Elena, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Elena Schneider is a campaign reporter for Politico, and she joined us to talk about a surge of former members of the Obama administration who are now running for public office.
Coming up, we'll hear about a new smile study at UW-Madison that says there are three basic types of smiles. We'll help figure out what they mean. Stay with us here on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, you'll get a chance to tell us what you think of removing Confederate monuments and markers after the city of Madison announced the removal of a Confederate memorial marker in a local cemetery.
Now, okay, Rob, I need you to give me a nice, lovely, big smile.
Okay, I'm going to get up to the mic so people can see it out there. This is why it's hard to get a good picture of me. I do better with candid shots.
And that was a lovely smile.
It was a lovely smile.
I have no idea what it meant, but hopefully our next guest does and can tell us a little more about it. She says smiles can express a lot of things, ranging from approval, to nervousness, even to misery.
Joining us now is Paula Niedenthal, professor of psychology at UW-Madison. She was involved in a study that looked at what emotions smiles can express. Paula, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thank you.
Well, reading up on your study, as I understand it, usually people just focused in the past on whether a smile was real and sincere or fake. My example of a smile was, fake. I do very poorly at faking sincere smiles. But you're looking at more than that. What are you trying to figure out about smiles?
Well, first of all, you did pretty well. And we can, the nice thing for radio is you can tell when people are smiling because it changes the sound of your voice.
Mm-hmm.
So that's cool. We were looking beyond the idea of true smiles indicate that somebody's feeling really happy inside versus anything else is a false smile. And we asked ourselves, basically, if smiles accomplish different things other than just telling somebody that you're feeling good, what could those things be? So the way we look at it is we ask, facial expressions solve a lot of interpersonal problems, ones that help us survive in group living and interacting with other people, and sometimes even more people who don't speak our language. And so we propose that different smiles may accomplish three absolutely fundamental tasks for human living. One is rewarding other people's behavior, making them do stuff again. One would be showing that there is no conflict between us, that I'm not threatening, that I'm open to making a social bond with you, which we call an affiliative smile, the former a reward smile. And another thing we can do with smiles is, in a safe way, that is a non-immediately aggressive way, signal that we're better than somebody else or negotiate status with somebody.
We'll dig deeper into what those mean and what those smiles look like in just a bit. But as I understand it, I don't know if this is true, actually. This is really important to Americans because we smile a lot compared to a lot of other countries. Is this true?
Yeah, the norm in the United States, but in many other countries that have some interesting commonalities with the United States, is to express smiles often. And there are a lot of data showing that, but also expressing smiles in many more situations, including ones that might involve service and that involve strangers. So we smile more. The fact that there might be three types of smiles doesn't deny the fact that people in other countries also have those kinds of smiles. They may not have them in this exactly the same situations because the problem may not be the same, and they may do it less frequently, particularly with strangers.
Okay, let's dig into these three different kinds of smiles. The reward smile, I'm rewarding you for being nice to me, I guess, or I'm hoping to motivate you to be nice to me by smiling.
That's one thing. I might make you or want you to repeat almost any behavior that you've just done. For example, we use reward smiles a lot with pre-verbal infants to get them to approach or to do something again. So it's not just that I'm doing something friendly or you're doing something friendly and I'm giving you a reward smile. You might have done anything. You might have given me a cigarette. I don't want one. But you might have engaged in some sort of other behavior that I really approve of. Give me a gift, for example.
Now, where is this happening? Because I don't think most people are rashly thinking, I would like this person to repeat that pleasant behavior. I will now deploy my reward smile.
They're not. I mean, there's certainly a learning component. That is that we feel good when other people make those smiles. So they do work. And what we learn when we make a certain kind of smile, even automatically, is somebody will be more likely to repeat the behavior. They also might mimic it, make it back to us, and we can feel how good that smile feels. So the nice thing about a smile of reward is, first of all of the smiles I'm talking about are spontaneous, non-deliberative smiles. So we would call them all real. But it's the minute you do something that I like, I'm going to do that reward smile back to you, and you're going to get very quick, positive, good feelings from having done that behavior. So that's why it'll work.
In your research, you get into a lot what these smiles look like with people actually evaluating smiling faces. Talk about how you tried to measure this.
Yeah, it's sort of hard because, as you kind of implied, people are not very deliberate about this. And yet now you guys are, and maybe people listening, are going to go outside and notice that they see what I'm going to call as an affiliative smile all the time. Because affiliative smiles are what we do on the street or at the elevator or when we're acknowledging each other without necessarily feeling good, just being acknowledging. What we did to figure out what the smiles look like, and we've done different kinds of studies, but the one you brought me into the studio for went like this. With some colleagues at the University of Glasgow in Scotland, we created very carefully and very, very complicatedly animations of people smiling. So these are animations, right? They're not actual smiles, in which there was always what we call the smile muscle or the zygomaticus muscle, major muscle, which means the things, the muscles on either side of our mouth that raises our lips to make the mouth look like it's smiling. So we put that into our animations, And either both sides of the lips went up or one. So either that's bilateral or unilateral, right?
Okay.
That was present.
I'm demonstrating for people at home.
Looks really good.
Okay.
You got a lot of control over your facial muscles. So that occurred in all of our cartoons or our animated faces. And then very systematically, we added other facial actions or other muscles that could be contracting during a smile. Some of you have heard in the past about the smile around the eye, which causes crow's feet. That could have been present in our animations. So after creating in a very systematic way to over 2,000 animations, we had subjects look at those animations and judge the extent to which no smile was present or evidence of these three meanings or signals, that is affiliation, dominance, and reward, after defining what we meant by that. And what we could do then was to create a sort of visual prototype of what each of the smiles looked like, and we could find out the extent to which each thing that happens in the face predicts the judgments of reward, dominance, and affiliation. So we could look, we could kind of figure out what they think they look like.
When you show these to different people, does everybody tend to agree, oh yeah, that one's the reward smile, that one's the dominant smile? People are pretty consistent on that?
Well, what we could do is after we had done the initial research where we really found out which facial actions lead people to make those judgments, is we could bring actors and actresses into our lab, which we did. We could teach them what we meant, and then they could realize that they knew what that was. And then we could actually make movies or films of real people making these smiles. And then we could show those to many, 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 many subjects and ask them very, very many questions, like, is this a smile at all? And that's the way that we could validate or find out whether or not people kind of agree, and they do agree. That was your question.
We're talking about the science behind smiles with Paula Niedenthal, professor of psychology at UW-Madison. We've touched on the reward smile. You mentioned the affiliative smile, like, hey, we're both pleasant people. We're not going to kill each other.
Right.
Yay. let's get into the third one, the dominant smile. That sounds like a less pleasant smile to me.
Yeah, it's not motivated by positive emotions, and yet it's a real smile. It's the dominant smile has an interesting characteristic, which is quite asymmetrical, meaning only one. Oh, you did a good job of that.
It looks like a sneer.
Bit like a sneer, but it is a smile in the sense that there's a lot of zygomaticus contraction. So, and when people see it, they call it a smile. You say, if you can say, is that a smile or not? People say it's a smile. So we have data showing that. But it has components of contempt in it. So that means that there's a little bit of your nose wrinkling, as in disgust or contempt, and it is not coming from a positive place. It's coming from a place of derision.
None of these three smiles sound like they come necessarily from happiness. They're not smiling to reflect that inner happiness. Like you were talking about the old way of defining a genuine or false smile.
The reward smile comes closest to that because it comes out of a place of really positive emotion. I mean, happiness is too big and too large a state, but oh, I liked that you did that. It made me feel good. Now I'm making this facial expression to reward you. That's the closest to what people would call the real smile, because people start with the presumption that smiles occur when people are happy. And so that's why they call that reward smile the real smile. Then they walk around after they're in my class or in my lab.
Or talking to you on the radio.
Then you walk around and you go, oh, no, people are smiling in many, many situations. And very few of them, would I say, or not all of them, at least, are the ones in which people are actually feeling, you know, joyous.
So what do we start to do with this now that we've classified these and figured out what's going on in our facial muscles from our mouths to our eyes that make these smiles? What's the next step in researching what this all means?
Yeah, who cares is the real question. And I think everybody should always ask that. Smiles are just like totally important in almost all kinds of exchanges, including in politics and international relations and in business. And people throw a lot of money at smiles these days, I would say even in the last decade. So the Chinese often teach employees who will be working in North America or in international business to smile. They do that often by having people put pencils in their mouth to force contraction of the particular smile muscle.
That sounds fun.
Yeah. It doesn't sound like it's going to work, though, right? Because it sounds like it could be false altogether. So Paris had a smile campaign in 2009 to try to woo more tourists who complained that there wasn't enough smiling. People who are plastic surgeons reanimate and reconstruct the smile. So a lot of money and time is spent on smiling without a lot of knowledge. And so basically what you want to do is figure out what smile is it actually that you're trying to put back on the face or put on the face of a politician.
I wanted to ask about that. Like for people who've gone through plastic surgery or reconstructive surgery, I understand that if if the smile doesn't come back right, it's really alienating for that person.
Yeah, there's a lot of, concern. The plastic surgeon would ask, and I've certainly spoken at Grand Rounds at UW Hospital, School of Medicine and Public Health. One question that a plastic surgeon would say is, if I can do one thing, what should I do? You know, if I can put one, if one facial expression could be better animated. And so you can ask yourself, and one would ask yourself, what's the frequency of these expressions and what goes into them? And how should we, you know, how should we improve this person's ability to make a facial expression? The other problem is that when there's facial paralysis, you don't do such a good job of knowing what other people's smiles mean, because one of the most important things about smiling is we know what the other person means by mimicking their smile. And if you don't have the opportunity to mimic smiles back, you're not sending the signal either that you understood or, and in fact, you probably didn't understand. So there's a lot that people who reanimate the face worry about when it comes to which smiles there are and what they really mean.
I want to ask about maybe an occupational hazard where you're talking about it. I can't stop smiling.
Oh. Like,
stop. Be serious, Rob. Stop. Is this, once you start thinking about it, is it really hard not to smile?
Well, I wouldn't call it a hazard then, because it's pretty nice.
I guess it's a good thing to smile, sure.
I like a smiley lab. It's not a quote-unquote hazard to smile more. It's in general pretty interesting and nuanced. I do notice that I'm paying attention to all the smiles, and so are my students, and so are the people, all the millions of undergraduates who work on this research in my lab. They become really sensitized to it, but they see it as a positive thing.
And then you brought in actors to do this, and we started talking about the old way of thinking, the fake smile versus real smile. Is it really possible to replicate these three different kinds of smiles on purpose for a good actor?
It's pretty hard. I mean, most of our actors and actresses, our professionals, could do it, but we really had to explain to them, think about being in that situation. And then they're like, oh, yeah, I guess when I'm just crossing somebody at the elevator, I really do this thing, and they would do the affiliative smile, which actually is quite often closed mouth smile with lips kind of tightly pressed against the, tightly pressed against the teeth. And then you say, yeah, that's it. But people have to get in their heads to kind of reenact that. I think in general, we go around making these smiles spontaneously. Getting the actors to do it was, yeah, more work.
Paula, thanks a lot for joining us. Very interesting.
Thank you so much for your interest in my research.
That was Paula Niedenthal, professor of psychology at UW-Madison and co-author of a new study, many studies before that one too, for that matter, on the science of smiles.
Coming up, we'll look at ongoing controversy over the removal of Confederate monuments after Madison Mayor Paul Soglin announced the removal of a Confederate plaque in Madison. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferrat. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferrat.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Weekday mornings from 6 to 9, it's the Joy Cardine Show. After 8, get two perspectives on the top state and national news on the Week in Review. This week, Foxconn, Charlottesville, and more controversial statements from the president. That's coming up tomorrow after 8 on the Ideas Network.
Now, Madison Mayor Paul Soglin ordered the removal of memorials to Confederate soldiers earlier today. The memorials are in the Forest Hill Cemetery on the city's near west side on public land. This comes on the heels of violence over the weekend in Charlottesville, Virginia, where white supremacists and others protested the removal of a statue of Confederate General Robert E. Lee. Baltimore also removed Confederate monuments earlier this week. Other cities and states have plans to do the same in the coming weeks and months.
And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you think that monuments that commemorate those involved in darker parts of our nation's history should be removed? Why or why not? And who do you think should decide? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Jim Grossman is the executive director of the American Historical Association. He joins us to talk about history, memory, and commemoration. Jim, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for inviting me. Good evening.
Well, obviously, the big story around the country, but here we have in Wisconsin the removal of this memorial, not in a Confederate state, interestingly. Are there a lot of Confederate memorials outside the old Confederacy?
Yes, there are. I mean, obviously, most of them are in the old Confederacy, but I think it's even possible that the last one that was built might have even been in Arizona. The governor of Maine actually spoke out, was it yesterday or today? I think yesterday, for some reason, saying that removing Confederate memorials was like would be like removing memorials to 9/11. So obviously, this is a national issue, and these things exist everywhere. Confederate memorials have been used from the time that they were first created, first built, in essence, as respectable ways to signify white supremacy. And so they're all over the country.
Can you talk about the eras in which a lot of Confederate memorials and monuments were built around the country?
Most of the first wave was between about 1895 or so and the second decade of the 20th century, which is, by the way, also sort of a period of a great amount of lynching, heyday of lynching, and racial lynching. And then the second period would be 1950s through the 1960s. So in the first case, you have these memorials being built during the period when legally mandated racial segregation is being created in the South. The Jim Crow laws are passed in the 1890s mostly. And the other thing that's going on, which is interesting, is disfranchisement. African Americans are voting from a few years after the Civil War up into the 1890s. So the first batch of these monuments are being built when white Southerners are, in essence, creating a regime of segregation and disfranchisement. And then the second batch are being built during the period when they're defending it against the civil rights movement. So in both cases, what you're seeing are ways of saying something politely in order to make a political statement about white supremacy.
Are there monuments, is there a case to be made that there could be monuments put up after the Civil War, maybe by families after, just remembering the massive loss of life of loved ones, regardless of the cause? Do these kind of monuments inevitably get attached to racism and the pro-slavery effort of secession?
Nothing is inevitable. So no, not inevitably at all. And so, yes, I'm sure that did happen. I'm sure that there are places, there are cases where that people put up statues to loved ones. But most of the statues that are arousing controversy are not statues to loved ones. I mean, statues to Robert E. Lee, Stonewall Jackson. That's very different here. And I do think that this is obviously a very complex subject. Communities should discuss this. Which is, I think, an important, wonderful thing to do for people to be discussing history and its significance. But there's a difference between different kinds of statues. Earlier on your announcement, you made a reference to statues of people involved in slavery or involved in the darker aspects of our history. That's not what we're talking about here. We're talking here about not people who were involved. We're talking about statues to people who have no other national significance other than the creation of the Confederacy. That's it. So this isn't a matter of people involved in one thing and another thing, and we're going to choose what to honor them for. Stonewall Jackson, Robert E. Lee, many of these people have one piece of significance, and that is the establishment of the Confederate States of America, which, according to the states that established it, were established to preserve and protect the institution of slavery.
Talking to Jim Grossman, Executive Director of the American Historical Association, looking at the removal of Confederate statues and memorials. Related to your last point, I want to give a listen to President Trump in his press conference earlier this week talking about statue removal.
Many of those people were there to protest the taking down of the statue of Robert E. Lee. So, this week it's Robert E. Lee. I noticed that Stonewall Jackson's coming down. I wonder, is it George Washington next week, and is it Thomas Jefferson the week after? You know, you really do have to ask yourself, where does it stop?
And Jim, from what you're just saying, you don't buy, it sounds like, that slippery slope argument.
No, I think it shows both an ignorance of history and a distortion of history. George Washington and Thomas Jefferson are not being honored because they're slaveholders. They're being honored because of their role in creating a democratic experiment. They were flawed individuals. The Constitution is a flawed document. The Declaration of Independence is a flawed document. But the creation of the United States of America is a historically significant event, and there is no reason why we shouldn't commemorate the individuals who played a central role in that great but flawed democratic experiment of the late 18th century. The creation of the Confederate States of America, I'm going to be blunt, has nothing to recommend it. And because if you look at the documents, the state of Mississippi was very clear in its Declaration of Secession, which is similar to the Declaration of Independence, obviously, or comparable, analogous. Our position is thoroughly identified with the institution of slavery, the greatest material interest of the world. This is very clear. This is what's going on here. And so what I would call on President Trump and your senators and your representatives is to, regardless of their position on memorials, it's a complicated issue, regardless of their position on any other interpretive or policy issue, is I would like to hear them say one simple sentence. The Confederacy was a bad idea. That simple. And then we can argue about memorials.
We'll go to our callers now. Maddie is with us in Black River Falls. Maddie, hi.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I have a question that would it be out of place to maybe have some of the more positive individuals have some sculptures or some other indication or plaques to identify where the goodness or where the severity of having the slavery to explain things on a plaque or with each statue or with an individual, maybe just the bust, to show that there's two sides to the story, but give a little bit more on the positive side, and I'll take my answer offline. Thank
Maddie,
you.
Thanks for the call. And we heard from historian Eric Foner earlier this week on the show, Jim, saying, where are the memorials to African Americans who served in Congress in the South during the Reconstruction era, or memorials to the slaves in the same vicinity as the Civil War generals?
Or memorials to people who were lynched. I mean, we memorialize victims quite frequently, as we have for 9/11, appropriately. Where are the memorials to people being lynched? In other words, I always have a problem. I think it's very important to be fair to both sides of an argument. However, I don't think that, and I'm perfectly happy to engage in a debate, by the way, with anybody who wants to debate about whether or not the Confederacy was a good idea or a bad idea. But I don't think that in our civic culture right now there are two sides to this as to whether the Confederacy was a good or a bad idea. So the two sides, in fact, might well be two ways of thinking about dealing with the problem of how to eradicate slavery. Okay, I'm okay with that if you could find that sort of debate, and I think that would be a great debate for a classroom. These are all interesting historical questions, but there aren't two sides here any more than in Charlottesville. You can equate neo-Nazis who are accompanied by neo-Confederates, but neo-Nazis, and people who are opposed to racism, who might well have politics that are further to the left than other people. And if you want to say there's two sides, there's people who are further to the left of other people and people further to the right of other people, that's fine. But neo-Nazis, no, that's not the other side. I'm sorry.
We're talking to Jim Grossman, Executive Director of the American Historical Association, looking at the history of Confederate monuments and the decision to remove them, not just in the South. One went away today in Madison.
You can tell us what you think at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Do you agree with Mayor Soglin's decision to remove this plaque? Do you see this move as one that divides or unifies the country? And how do you think that we should approach monuments associated with slavery and racist aspects of American history? You can tell us what you think at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time.
This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation with Jim Grossman, Executive Director of the American Historical Association, talking about the removal of Confederate memorials. Today, Madison Mayor Paul Soglin announced the removal of a plaque at the Confederate Rest section of a local public cemetery on public land.
And you can weigh in, tell us what you think by calling 800-642-1234. 1234. Do you think that Madison should remove the plaque at the Confederate Rest section of the cemetery? Do you think that this is a move that unites the country, or do you see it as divisive? And how do you think we should be looking at the Civil War, slavery, segregation, and other racially charged parts of American history? Call us at 800-642-1234.
We'll go to our callers. Greg with us in Kenosha. Greg, hi, you're on the air.
Yes, my comment was, it's a part of the history, and we cannot just say, oh, the Confederates, they like white supremacist ideology and like ideal monuments, but it's about the people who actually fought during the Civil War and actually fought for their ideas and died for it. And monuments are, like, represent them and their families who actually believe in the ideas. And I'm not a white person, and like people just need to get over themselves. Yes, white supremacists believe in that, but it doesn't mean that we need to get on their level and start ruining every monument. In future, maybe our beliefs will change again, so let's ruin the rest of the monument that actually exists that does not come up with our beliefs now. Just let's live on, let's build other monuments actually which represent our times, instead of like ruining everything that we don't believe anymore.
Greg, thanks for the call. Leave the monuments up, I guess, as a monument to the time in which they were built, and build some more of our own, Greg says. Jim?
I can understand that position, and I think that if we left the monuments up and we made it clear on the text of them what the historical content, why they were built, they were not, again, they, in most cases, they were not built to commemorate heroes. They were built for a political purpose to create consensus of white supremacy. If we improve the quality of history education in our schools so that students were learning a little more about this. But I also think that we have to consider whether what it is that you're honoring when you build a monument, because monuments stand as kind of centerpieces of civic culture. And yes, some communities might decide to leave them up, some take them down. I think it's imperative for every community to have this discussion, and to have this discussion in the context of some kind of historical knowledge. If there is a Confederate monument in Kenosha, I want to know why it's there before we decide to take it down or not. And I also think that to the extent that Confederate monuments do symbolize some kind of approval of the reason for establishing the Confederacy in the first place, then I want to see at least the local political leadership renounce that. Say, okay, we're going to keep this up because it's part of our history, but we're also going to say that the Confederacy was a bad idea. I'm not sure whose congressional district Kenosha is in, but whoever it is should be asked whether he or she is willing to say the Confederacy was a bad idea.
I want to ask, as we start to wrap up, Jim, I mean, we've been arguing about how to remember the Civil War since the Civil War ended. Basically, what would you like to see in memorials in the South, in the North, wherever, that can be a positive contribution to how we start to think about this?
Well, I think, first of all, we need more, we probably need more Civil War memorials that make it clear that the Civil War in its outcome, because that's what you often are remembering, in its outcome was a war of liberation, because that's what it was. The Civil War, at great national cost, the 600,000 people who died, that's a huge cost. The Civil War liberated 4 million Americans from enslavement. That's a tremendous accomplishment. So these people, these 600,000 people, they died for something, or at least those who died on behalf of the people who were being liberated. But these people died for a cause, so the Civil War should not be seen as something of a tragedy, other than the loss of life and people being, all wars are tragedies, but the Civil War is a tragedy only in the sense it's too bad we had to fight it. If we had not had that war, how much longer would slavery have lasted as an institution in American life? So I think that's one thing that I think is absolutely imperative in all monuments to the Civil War, is the cost, the emphasis on the number of people who died and how tragic it is that people had to die in a fight over something like this. And then the other is the accomplishment, which was the liberation of 4 million people. That's what the Civil War story is.
We'll leave it there for now. Jim, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for inviting me.
Jim Grossman is the executive director of the American Historical Association. He joined us to give us a historian's perspective on removing Confederate monuments after, of course, the national debate. And now today in Madison, the mayor, Paul Soglin, announced the removal of a federal plaque from a Madison cemetery on public land.
Great Lakes scientists are concerned about possible federal budget cuts affecting their work. The fate of federal spending next year on Great Lakes research is still foggy, but the potential of less money to study water pollution and other issues has some scientists speaking up. Chuck Kornbach reports.
Congress has started to reverse some of President Trump's budget plans announced a few months ago for the Great Lakes. It now looks like the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative won't be zeroed out, and neither will the Sea Grant program. But it's a little too early to say for sure about possible smaller cuts. Scientists are also concerned about potential trimming to research funded by the Environmental Protection Agency and other federal departments. Scientists like UW-Milwaukee's Sandra McClellan. McClellan dumps a bucket of water she's just pulled from the Lake Michigan Harbor in Milwaukee. The professor of freshwater sciences and her students take a lot of samples from the lake. McClellan says her team is typically looking for bacteria.
What we really want to know is what is the load of these bacteria from the city when it rains? The storm water, leaking sewage, sometimes when it's really severe, combined sewer overflows.
Some of McClellan's work has been federally funded. As the UW-Milwaukee research vessel, the Niske, moved across the harbor, she was asked what studies would be slowed or harmed if research money was cut.
I don't even know where to start.
McClellan then talked about work she's done to reduce pollution at Milwaukee beaches. The studies are entering a new phase looking at the source of harmful bacteria.
So we have an experiment deployed now up the shoreline at a secret location buried with E. coli. And we're going to see who's the last guy standing and what's the genetics of those E. coli.
Other researchers at the UW-Milwaukee say they also worry about plans to take away federal dollars. Professor Harvey Bootsma says cuts might delay a scientific analysis of whether there are proper limits on phosphorus going into Lake Michigan. He says agencies like the Wisconsin DNR are trying to decide what level of the chemical is right to provide more food for fish, but not adding to harmful algae.
We don't quite have the answer to that yet. And it may be that you can't do both of those completely to your satisfaction. You may have to find some compromise there.
According to a supporter of federal budget cuts, a middle ground is all he wants. Sterling Burnett of the Illinois-based Heartland Institute says the Trump administration isn't trying to stop science funding, but Burnett says Washington has to start reducing debt and deficits.
We have to tighten our belts, and that means the federal government has to get back to its core responsibilities. And you won't find energy mentioned in the Constitution. You won't find environment mentioned in the Constitution. You'll find national defense.
Burnett says it may be time for states like Wisconsin to step up spending on Great Lakes research. But UW-Milwaukee Freshwater Sciences Assistant Dean Eric Leaf says that doesn't seem likely.
Increasingly, we're seeing, for example, departments of natural resources shrinking or losing their scientists.
Leaf also says the Great Lakes are an international body of water, and it's up to national governments in the U.S. and Canada to fund most of the studies. The budget discussions will resume next month when Congress returns to Washington. But even programs that might escape a big slicing this year are gearing up for several years of battle. Moira Harrington is with Sea Grant.
I think we fully expect in every year of this remaining administration to see this sort of, you know, attack on any kind of environmental science program.
Harrington says Sea Grant and other agencies will just have to have faith in their mission and be prepared to prove their value to elected officials. Chuck Kornbach, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, the trade deal NAFTA is getting a new look this week with the beginning of a contentious renegotiation process. We'll find out what's at stake.
The solar eclipse keeps getting closer. We'll check out the science behind the event and why it creates such a sense of wonder.
And on Food Friday, we'll learn how to make our own versions of store-bought treats at home, from Oreos to Cheez-Its.
That and look at the top news of the day coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.